for a second appearance here on the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, King Size Truth for Radio Size Speakers. Please welcome Mr. James Matthew Wilson. Good morning, James. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I am well. Thank you very, very much. What was this last book of yours that you and I talked about?
Vision of the Soul.
Vision of the Soul. That's right. And since then, you have been busy writing poetry.
Well, I'm always writing poems, but occasionally I take a break to write a little philosophy. That book was.
Now, when you say you take a break write a little philosophy, from what little you heard, did it sound like my philosophy of Perennis on this commonality in humanity was correct?
Well, from what I heard, I came in a little late.
So, human nature is one of the things that was brought up in this piece that we were talking about. And she was the writer was saying that, well, now finally we're having dialogue and we can all now realize our common human nature because we're sitting across from each other and not screaming and hollering. And I'm going, human nature is not something that you get an option to recognize. A nature, by nature, the fact that it is a nature, means that every incident of it or every being in the species has that nature, correct?
That's correct. If you need to talk to somebody else to figure out what human nature is, then you're probably not talking about human nature.
If you need to talk someone to figure out not about what human nature is, but that we have a common human nature, you're probably not talking about human nature, then, are you?
That's also true. Yeah.
Just thought I'd get to the bottom of this. Now, what is this Station of the Cross? Now, this is a 14-part cycle that you published. But you mentioned something in our little Twitter exchange there about performing it or reading it,
right.
I guess.
Yeah. So probably, you know, it was 5 years ago, I thought at the time, but back in late 2012, the Catholic poet and former chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, Dana Gioia, published an article called The Catholic Writer Today. And the article generated a lot of conversation in various magazines and on the internet because he was arguing that in the mid-20th century, Catholic writers were shaping American culture. And just an example of that being Flannery O'Connor or Thomas Merton. And that in the contemporary world, we've really been either pushed to the margins or isolated ourselves in a ghetto. And I had always considered my published work as being deeply infused by my Catholicism, not in the sense of making me a Catholic writer, because I'm not quite sure what that necessarily would be, but but certainly in the sense of that I hope that my work displays a deeper vision than is available in the work of a lot of contemporary, more secular artists. And but I came to appreciate that through reading his essay, that one thing I hadn't ever done was try to accomplish something like a genuinely sacred art, something that would be both a good work of art, but something that would also be capable of, in some sense, being used in an act of worship.
Okay.
So I sat back and I thought what I've always really wanted to do is to write a Stations of the Cross. And so I began working on it. It took me about 3 years working on it off and on to get it right. But by the time I was done, I had a long poem in the stanza of the Stabat Mater, which I don't know about you, but whenever I go to Stations of the Cross at my parish, we always sing a verse from the Stabat Mater at the end of every station.
Okay, that's right.
And it didn't accomplish quite what I had hoped. That is to say, it's less genuinely a work of sacred art or devotional art than, at least on the surface, than I had intended, but the result was nonetheless what I thought was a pretty good poem. So it's the individual stations started appearing in magazines more than 3 years ago, and then last year the Clarion Review published the entire sequence along with illustrations by the great Chicago artist and Catholic convert Daniel Mitsui.
Oh, okay. That's who did the drawings for this that I'm looking at.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, because they look original. I'm looking at these going like, well, they're not stained glass reliefs. They're not frescoes. So it looks like somebody actually drew these. Now, I just put the link in our chat room at MikeChurch.com to click on Mike Church Show Live Chat so you can see what he was talking about. Would you read for us stanza three? Or do you want me to read it? I'd be happy to if you want, but I wanted you to read it.
The Jesus Falls the First Time?
Yes.
Okay, good. So here's the third station, Jesus Falls the First Time. There is a question scholars ask, or used to ask. Given the cask of vital spirits that was Christ's tomb, can our age speak of tragedy anymore? Or is comedy the only plot left in the room? Where Hector glowered at the shield, knowing that fate would never yield till ruin spread o'er the place he stood. Now the scene that follows a fall is an uplifting, after all. Lazarus comes out and eats some food. I'm sure you wondered much the same as your back opened up in pain and sprawled beneath the blood-soaked wood.
It's beautiful. Folks, you got to read this and contemplate this. Of course, now on Holy Thursday, we have a reenactment and a reminder of what we call the Last Supper. And then usually on Good Friday, you can go to a Mass, and sometimes either before or after, there is the Station of the Cross. And as you said, you know, you'll read the Station of the Cross as it's written in the litany, if you will, mm-hmm. and then they'll follow mm-hmm. it at the end with the Stabat Mater. Mm-hmm. But that's not a poetic reading. That's more of a kind of a doctrinal reading, one that's been approved. And I like the cadence that you have to this. Now, did you say that you had performed this somewhere? Did you read it to an audience, or is it just published?
That's right. So I just finished a lecture tour in my home state of Michigan.
Okay.
Went to a series of smaller colleges, and I was going to visit one of the stops was a small college called Rochester College, and I was trying to do something different at every stop on this tour so that if people wanted to follow along, they would actually be worth their time coming out. So I proposed to them something I'd always wanted to do, which, as I said, I started this sequence 5 years ago. I think I finished the first sections of it started appearing in print 4 years ago, and it's going to be collected in print in my next book of poems, which will be out this fall from Angelico Press. But what I had never done is in any way recited the poems publicly. My last book of poems, Some Permanent Things, is still selling pretty well, and so when I give readings, I strictly have been reciting from that book just to continue, since it's my most recent book of poems. But I really wanted to arrange an evening where people could hear the poems, see art from around the world mm-hmm. representing the Stations of the Cross.
Right.
And also get a little more of a historical background on the origin of the stations and where they came from. It's the Stabat Mater. It's just so fascinating. You probably know your Dante. And when I think of the great poetry of Christendom, I think of Dante's Divine Comedy. If you talk to an Italian, you'd say that the second great poet of medieval Italy is Jacopone da Todi. And when I first heard his name, da Todi, I thought, I really do not know who that is. And then I realized that I had been reciting da Todi's poetry since my childhood. I mean, the melody to his version of Stabat Mater has been, I've been carrying that around in my memory my entire life. I sometimes would just break out humming it, and I had no idea it was a toady. So part of the performance was to make people conscious of the toady's contribution to.
Now, do you read the Stabat Mater in Latin, or do you read it in English?
I had it up projected for them. Of course, I was projecting slides because of the artwork I was showing everyone.
So I had
Caswell's translation available to them, but I was singing it in the Latin, just so they'd hear what I had heard.
Okay, because I'm going to say, Stabat Mater, that is Latin, that's standing mother. So we ought to say, not call it the Stabat Mater. If you're going to say it in English, it's just call it by its English name. But it's beautiful either way. I mean, it really is. I take Pope Benedict, the 16th exhortation to the modern world, that you do a lot of good for yourself as a practicing Catholic if you start learning all the essential prayers in Latin. So I've knocked most of them out. I'm working, you know what I'm working on right now? I'm working on the Litany of the Virgin, the Litany of the Blessed Virgin Mary, which, as you know, is quite long. But I'm learning a lot about Latin, too, that I didn't know. So
it's a way to learn the language. I admire your admiration there. I had a student, actually, last semester who was always carrying his Catholic prayers in Latin around with him, and I finally asked him what he was doing, and he was doing that. He was working on memorizing his prayers in Latin.
Yeah, I knocked a rosary out a couple of years ago, so I can do that whole thing start to finish. But anyways, let's get back to the Stations of the Cross. Now, James Matthew Wilson is my special guest here on our Dude Maker Hotline at 844-527-8723. And his last book, your last book is available from Angelico, too. Is that correct?
No, the Vision of the Soul was published by Catholic University.
Okay, well, that's right. We talked about that. So you can find the book out there, The Vision of a Soul, out there. Probably at major booksellers. There, we don't have it. I need to get with with the university bookman and talk to him about this. But are you now? Obviously, Passion Week is coming. Holy Week is coming up. You have plans on reading this thing anywhere?
I don't have plans at this time. I mean, I guess my little stop at Rochester College will have to do it for this Lent. but my plan is, as it's probably the last 3 years, been my work and verse has been getting a lot more attention. So my hope is to begin an annual reading of this during Lent. And actually this Christmas, I have a book of my Christmas poems coming out, and I'm hoping that I'll establish an annual reading of the Christmas poems. But this is just me thinking aloud right now. No formal plans.
Well, let's talk about poems and poetry for just a moment. Has any of your work been published in the STAR, in the St. Austin Review?
Yes, and they published a really nice review of my last book too.
I saw that. I must have missed the publication of the poems, because I always, whenever I get my St. Austin Review, which, by the way, folks, if you're listening, our very own Joseph Pierce, host of the Piercing Truth Show, is the grand editor, the grand poobah editora of the St. Austin Review, which. You will find it online if you look for it. It's not the easiest thing to find, but it's a beautiful magazine. And I like the fact that it comes as a magazine and that they kind of resisted the temptation. No, we'll publish some teasers online, but no, we actually want you to hold the magazine in your hand. James, once upon a time, poets were the actors and actresses and superstar celebrities of their day. And, of course, the first name that comes to mind that may have been one of the last ones that many people would go like, oh, yeah, okay, would be Oscar Wilde. Now, Wilde did write a novel, and he did write some plays, but he's principally known for his poetry. I'll give you a modern poet that people don't think is a poet. They just think he's a rock star. And that would be the one and only Bob Dylan. I mean, Dylan's work, to me, always sounds like and reads like poetry. So there's something of the good, the true, and the beautiful in poetry. And, of course, in the modern world, they've tried to haiku it. That's not the right word. Try to modernize it. It makes no sense. It's not good, true, and beautiful. It's just a bunch of rambling that they think is poetry. What is it that, from the poet point of view, that makes good poetry? Is it the cleverness or the cadence of achieving the rhyme? Because I know they don't all have to rhyme, because they certainly don't. But if you think of, like, one of my favorite poems to read, and you can read this to your young boys, ladies, is Brave Horatius at the Bridge. That's a great poem to read to young men. They'll get a lot out of it. So what is it that makes great poetry?
So let me plug another of my books.
Sure, please do. Absolutely.
In between publishing some permanent things, my last book of poems and The Vision of the Soul, I published a book called The Fortunes of Poetry in an Age of Unmaking.
Ah.
And that book is, I thought of it when I was writing it as a kind of one stop shop for the despairing conservative intellectual. Because the first 100 pages of it are just a polemic that takes you on a tour of contemporary American poetry and shows how contemporary poetry has destroyed itself. And then, my little 3-year-old Cecilia just came in the room here. The last one third of it is a philosophy of poetry, as in explaining why poetry has occupied the absolutely central place it has in Western civilization, and in fact, in every civilization. And then has as an appendix a guide to prosody, so that most people don't learn poetry in the school the way up to 100 years ago it would have been standard practice to do. And so it's in 30 pages that teaches you everything you need to know about the craft of verse. But so in the philosophy of poetry I offer there, I say that poetry has always been thought of in terms of 4 M's, making, memory, metaphor, and meter. And what I mean by that is this. We've always thought of poetry as the first, or the kind of primary kind of making.
Okay.
The paradigmatic art form. So we know that because when somebody makes something really well, even if we've never read a poem in our life, we say, oh, that's pure poetry. Right? The receiver who reaches up and makes a one-handed catch and then runs in for the touchdown, we say that's poetry in motion. We know that poetry is the first kind of making. It's sort of our standard of what it means for human beings to make something excellent. And the reason for that is because poetry, in several senses, comes from our memory. And what I mean by that is this. The 9 muses, they all have a mother, and their mother's name is Mnemosyne, memory. So memory is the mother of the arts. And I think what the ancient Greeks were trying to get at when they proposed that is that it's memory. It's the capacity to remember the past and also to enter into the depths of our interior self. Memory is a faculty of the soul, the way St. Augustine talked about it.
Right.
It's memory that allows us to gather all the disjecta membra of time and experience and see them as a unified and orderly whole. So in other words, the difference between life and a story is that a story is life once it's been gathered by memory and made into an integral whole. So so poetry as this child of memory does 2 things. It tells the stories that we all hold in common, but it also, memory is the mother of the muses. So poetry as memory is also that art form where something new comes into the world. You know, the muses all hang out in Parnassus or some sacred wood where prophetic truths come into the world that we didn't know before. So if you're going to say something new, there shouldn't be an established language for it. So where do you get words to describe what's unprecedented, what's never been in the world before? You need metaphor for that. and poetry has always used metaphors to express what was otherwise unexpressible.
Ah.
The ambiguities of the interior life, or just the figure of speech that allows us to see some profound truth we couldn't understand before. My favorite example being, because it's one of the earliest, in Plato's Phaedrus, Socrates says to his companion Phaedrus, he says, I want to tell you what the soul is. But you know what? If I was going to tell you what the soul was, literally, we'd have to be here all day. So just take my word for it. The soul is like a chariot with a charioteer and two winged horses, one of whom is good and obedient, the other of whom is refractory and stubborn and lustful. So there we have a metaphor for the soul. It's such a good metaphor that you hardly need to know what the soul actually is because you've got the perfect metaphor for it. There's one more element. Memory and metaphor have always been one in poetry with meter, and for a number of reasons. Meter makes poetry memorable.
Okay.
But also the orderliness of speech. When we really give measure or number to our language, we sense that we're refining our language so that it more adequately reflects the intrinsic order of the universe, the order of God's creation. And so, in a certain sense, memory is also the first metaphor. It's the first moment we say this literal ordering of syllables metaphorically represents the orderliness of the world that we're trying to discover and understand.
Wow. So the book is The Fortunes of Poetry in an Age of Unmaking. And then if you want the Stations of the Cross, you can find it at the March 2017 last year Clarion Review. We have both links in our chat room at MikeChurch.com. I'll have both links in our audio recap and rundown of this interview. James, that's all the time that we have for today. I appreciate it. Maybe you can come back on Holy Week, and then we could do another Station or Two of the Cross.
Oh, I'd love to.
Well, thank you very much, brother. Always good to hear from you.
Thanks, Mike. I hope we'll talk soon.